Lutrenko took place in Alexandria, Virginia on October 27th, 1988.
We broke off last time. You were talking about the situation in the fall of 1978. And later in November, after General Hazari had banned public meetings, National Front leaders, among others, called for demonstrations and strikes on the first and last days of Muharram. Do you recall how Muharram was observed in Tabriz?
That year, honestly, I don't. I'm sorry. If demonstrations were called for, I can have to assume that Tabriz saw demonstrations. At this point in time, I just don't recall.
Now, one phenomenon of the revolution was the appearance of the comités. The pronunciation of Boston.
Comité.
When did they start appearing in Tabriz?
The comité started to appear visibly, as opposed to underground comités, but started to appear visibly in the period after the surrender, so-called, or submission of the armed forces and the government to Khomeini. Bakhtiar was still in Iran, still in theory the acting or the prime minister, but the civil authorities basically went home. The military authorities, police, gendarmerie, army, the martial law, you know, enforcers, basically went back to their barracks for a while, and their place was taken by small groups of sometimes armed, sometimes not armed men. For example, the consulate in Tabriz, the protection of the consulate was turned over to one of the local mosques and given to a particular comité to watch. At this point, this would be late January, early February of 1979, the comité system included just about everybody, anyone you could think of. It became the thing to join. Members were not screened very well, since everybody was part of the revolution. It started to change very rapidly when the comité system became armed. That happened within a few days of the groups becoming public. And by February 14, 15, 16, the comité system was, while still a bit chaotic, it was in effect all over Iran.
But these had they had underground existence in the previous months? Or
well, this, the people on the comité, the men, many of them, of course, had taken part in the demonstrations, but many of them were also neighborhood groups. A comité, for example, we're sitting in an apartment building right now. A typical comité, if this were Iran, would have been a group of men from this particular apartment complex who joined together to both defend the apartment complex and also to monitor and control access to it, and also to carry out instructions of the new religious authorities about the various dwellers in the apartment complex. Now, the comités were a really sort of chaotic mixture of all sorts of upper class, lower class, middle class, workers, factory owners, everything. Because for many people it became the way to get yourself immediately onto the bandwagon, join the comité, so that you can protect your own house by being a member of the group that's, you know, sort of given the authority to watch that street or watch that alley or watch that part of the town. Let me go back to one thing. The original structure of the comité, though, of the thousands and thousands of comités that sprang up and became public, was in the mosque. The local prayer leaders, the local mullahs, had at least been very instrumental in setting up the original comités, along with all the other revolutionary groups, the Mujahideen, the Fedayeen, groups like that.
You mentioned the last two organizations, you mentioned the Mojanti and the Fedayeen. Were they very active in the last months of 78? Did they manifest themselves in any way in late 78, early 79, before the transfer of power proper?
Yes, although the problem is, of course, that nobody wore a label on their back saying, I'm a member of the Mujahideen. Talking to Mujahideen figures later, in 1979, in the springtime and the summer, when things were becoming a lot more relaxed, they went on at great length about various acts they had done or activities they were involved in during the course of the 1978 revolutionary year. Including things like sort of inflaming crowds, doing other things to cause reaction from crowds against the government. But yes, they were involved. They were also involved, of course, publicly. You know, some of the major Mujahideen figures were very public about it in Europe.
What kind of a role, if any, was Savak playing at Tabriz at the end, the final months of the old regime?
That's also difficult to say. The reason is, I knew very few people in Savak. I knew a few of the commanders. They, of course, would not walk out on the streets themselves. I didn't really see any of them the last couple of months. I would assume they were continuing their intelligence role and cooperating with the local police, with the local army. But the actual law enforcement, as you know, if you want to call it that, or actual security control of the city of Tabriz, was being done by the army, by soldiers, and not by Savak or policemen.
I've read that around mid-December, military officers were working with Ardashir Zahedi, were trying to stage pro-Shah demonstrations around the country. How much evidence of pro-regime activity or support was there in Tabriz?
Very, very little, including members of the local government. I know there was some pro-Shah activity. I think there was a large demonstration in Tehran in roughly August, September of 1978, rather. A large demonstration was held at Amjadiya Stadium, very close to the American Embassy. It was sort of a last gasp. It would have been very silly, and Iranians are basically not silly people, would have been very silly to have taken part in a pro-Shah demonstration by late in 1978. The handwriting was writ large on the wall, and so many top regime figures had already run away from their country and from their responsibilities, that I can't imagine anyone else being interested in doing it. You're talking about a time when lots of high-ranking military, high-ranking others, officials, were shipping out as much of their property as they could from the country, shipping out their families, and basically hightailing it themselves to sort of, on a whole series of excuses, or just disappearing.
And this was a subject of great concern in Washington, the disposition of for the military towards the revolution. I think there was here in Washington that there'd be some kind of accommodation.
Well, there was an accommodation, yeah.
You mentioned last time to some extent the Air Force generals who are...
The Air Force homophiles, large numbers of the Air Force had already gone over to the other side. I also knew a number of individual, military who were very pro-revolutionary. Who would sit and talk about this, but of course had to keep the pretense up of loyalty to the Shah in public. I certainly knew a fair number of Iranian policemen, police officers, who were pro-revolution. And when I think of how many I knew, I can only multiply that by hundreds of thousands around the country. I can remember incidents of gendarmerie, talking to some gendarmerie figures. Not figures, just some normal gendarmes out at one of the gendarmerie posts outside of Tabriz once, in the late summer, it would have been, 1978. And when I was sitting there talking to them by myself, one of them pulled out a picture of Khomeini from his wallet, showed it to me, and, gave me a small lecture on the glories of this new religious leader. Well, I'd see that fairly frequently. there wasn't much reason for a lot of people to be loyal to the Shah. A lot of the benefits never came down to them. Mm-hmm. And they could see what was happening in the streets. And people in Tabriz have never been particularly pro-Shah anyway. They hadn't been in a long time. If they had ever been.
Now, I guess in mid-December, there were also more shootings of demonstrators. Khomeini and the National Front together called for another general strike on December 18th. According to one account, when the strike occurred in Tabriz, about 500 dissident soldiers with tanks went over to the side of the demonstrators. Did you hear about that, or did you recall that episode?
If that is the story that BBC ran, it was a lie.
I'm not sure what the source was.
BBC was particularly, was accused a great deal by the Iranian Pahlavi regime as being pro-revolutionary and lying in their news accounts. I know examples of their misuse of the truth. The story about a large number of military, particularly infantry, going over to the revolutionary forces was given out by BBC. Even though they knew it wasn't true, they still broadcast it as news. And the other reason I know about that is I was called up one day in Tabriz by the BBC representative, or one of them from Tehran, and he told me the story that, you know, he had heard a large number of people, officers from the army base there, etc., and others, and tanks, the whole bit, had gone over to the revolutionary regime. There had been a great deal of trouble at the base, and what could I confirm this story? Well, I told him that as far as I knew it wasn't true. This would have been within a couple of days of Christmas.
Yeah, that's the day, December 18th.
Okay, it would have been...
That's the date that I got.
Okay, yeah. But I told him that it wasn't true, and I said, you know, just by chance, I was playing cards with three or four officers who had just come over from the base. They were sitting in my kitchen, we were playing cards. These were all Iranians. And I turned to them and asked them if they knew anything about this, and one of them looked at me and said, "Do you think we'd be sitting here playing cards in your kitchen if it were true?" The logic impressed me. You know, and they were friends of mine who were out there playing cards, and they just come from the base. So I told them that I could, you know, confirm that it was not true. It was later that same evening. I had gone to a Christmas party, or a holiday party, at the home of a foreign friend in Tabriz. By chance, the British military team was also there. And he came over and asked me if I had heard that crazy story. I said I had, and he said, "You know, it's funny, now I got a call from Tehran." You know, he had gotten a call from Tehran, from BBC and Reuters, and they had asked if it were true, and he had said, "No, of course not, you know, because I've been on the base all day." And despite his saying it, the chief British military officer, and my confirming that it was not true, they ran the story as news later that night.
Interesting.
Because I listened to the BBC broadcast. That's incredible. But that was one example of what BBC was doing.
Now, a few days later, on December 25th, there was an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. A minor attack, but I guess an attack of some sort. I'm not sure what the circumstances were. How much concern did you have about your personal safety or the security of the consulate by this period, you know, late December?
A fair amount, but I was also pretty well protected. And I was constantly being reassured that nothing would happen to the consulate. There was also not much choice by this period of, you know, doing anything else. It was not easy to travel in Iran. Most of the time, when there were large demonstrations like this, it meant that planes were not flying. You certainly couldn't hope to get from Tabriz to Tehran by car. So I simply stayed there. Now, the consulate in Tabriz was subject to a very large, rather violent attack, and I think that was in late December. I'd have to go back and check the dates. But a couple of thousand Iranians did try and storm it. And basically they were beaten off with tear gas. but we lost, we had quite a bit of damage to the consulate. Things like broken windows, the guardhouse was, the greenhouse was burned out, the guardhouse was attacked. But I had 15 or 20 Iranian soldiers who had shown up, and they basically defended the perimeter, or defended the consulate building. They could, by shooting what must have been a couple of hundred tear gas bombs off. The demonstrators then went down and burned a Turkish consulate down the street. A Turkish consul received an apology about a day or two later from one of the leading clergymen of the city, and the Turkish consul was told that they were very sorry the crowd had thought it was the American consulate.
What kind of attitudes towards Americans in the U.S. were you encountering by this stage?
Attitudes by, you know, from the Iranians towards the U.S.? Very mixed. A lot of it was emotional, but there were still an awful lot of Iranians, there still are, who had ties to the United States. There was certainly no rancor expressed towards me as a person. Now, some of the clergy did slander me, I know, in speeches and things like that. But I didn't pay attention to that. I had a large number of Iranian friends. Others would come and express their own support or their interest in my welfare, the consulate's welfare. I was being presented petitions and letters by various of the revolutionary types to please send this to President Carter to explain, you know, how bad the Shah is, that sort of thing. And in many ways, the consulate was open off and on. It was open almost all the time, except for those days when there was massive rioting in the city. And people continued to come for visas and continued to come for other work. And I also had a very active social life this whole time, too.
Now, on December 30th, the Shah appointed Shapur Bakhtiar as Prime Minister, and Bakhtiar took the job on the condition the Shah would take a vacation in due course. What did you think about the decision to appoint Bakhtiar? What was your take on that?
I'm trying to remember. To me, at the time, he was just another one in a long series of attempts that were too late. There was a joke which became very current when after the Shah left and Imam Khomeini was already back. It was already into Bazar Gan's era, but people talked about, you know, Bakhtiar's appointment as being 10 years too late and 3 months too early. But, you know, a lot of these names like Azhari and Bakhtiar and this person and that person, these were not particularly well known to the mass of people. They would have been known to the political aficionados in Tehran and to members of the National Front or various other political groups, but most people just didn't know them. He was not famous in non-political circles.
Apparently when Bakhtiar became Prime Minister, the Ayatollah Shariat Madari?
Shariat Madari.
Sorry.
No, of course, yes, Shariat Madari. Yeah.
Threw a support to Bakhtiar. So I've read. I'm not sure if that's the case, but in any case, because the Ayatollah was from Tabriz, did that give Bakhtiar much support in the area?
By the time Bakhtiar took power, and he never really actually had power, he used to go to the office and hope that he could make it inside, I think. By the time he was given the job of Prime Minister, it was far too late. It was certainly far, there was a tidal wave going on. And this person or that person, even someone as prominent as Shariat Madari, providing him support wouldn't have made a bit of difference at that point. It was all just sort of prelude to Khomeini's return. It's strange, actually. Bakhtiar could have been Khomeini's prime minister just as easily as he was the Shah's. In fact, probably more easily. If he had just waited a little while. We got him back to France, which is where he really wanted to live anyway.
He seems like a real Parisian. His
wife is French, his son works for the French Secret Service. His family never lived, they didn't live in Iran, they were French. Typical Persian high official, unfortunately. It often was a country ruled by foreigners. The Persians who were foreign to Persia.
Did you have much contact with Shari Ladari's followers? And Tabriz?
In Tabriz, yes. I knew several people who were very close to him. Mm-hmm. I was asked at one point if I would go to home and meet him. This was in the summer of 1978. I passed on the request to the embassy and they told me no. But I never met him personally. I've met various members of his family since then, since the revolution. But I never did meet him personally. You have to remember that one thing about Tabriz was in many ways a small city. It was less than 1 million in population. When you think of the rather small group of foreigners, of officials, of upper class, whatever you want to call them, socially prominent in the city, it was rather small. He and members of his family would have known me just by, you know, knowing who was living in the big house in the center of the city.
Now, a few weeks later, in early January 79, General Robert Heiser arrived in Tehran with the assignment of pulling the military together.
Ha! That's crazy, Glue.
That was his mission. Mm-hmm. And to show U.S. support for Bakhtiar as well,
yeah.
I take it. How much did you know about the Heiser mission at the time?
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
I didn't even hear about Heiser until after the revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, until after, you know, February of 79.
I was wondering if his arrival had any impact on opinion in Tabriz, you know, any impact on the revolutionaries or...
No, but nobody ever mentioned his name to me.
So,
in fact, the first time I heard of him, I think I was already back in Tehran and had to ask who he was, because I had no idea. His visit was not publicized, to the best of my knowledge, in Tehran or in Iran.
I think word maybe got out in Tehran to some extent.
But I mean, not publicized in the papers or news or things like that.
Yeah.
It all seems sort of silly in retrospect. You want to stem a revolution, which particular person do we know who can go and talk to the few generals? Right.
Now, in that same month, many cities had mass demonstrations against Bakhtiar, calling for the return of Khomeini.
You know, by wintertime, demonstrations were going on all the time. And there were no normal days anymore. And by wintertime also, I'm only, just to put this again into perspective, by wintertime, when it was getting dark at 5 o'clock or so, 5:30 in the afternoon, martial law started not much later than that. And November, December, January, there was a great deal of chanting in the dark. Tires would be rolled out and set on fire in the streets. It was very eerie. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that was responsive to my question. Now the Shah finally left the country in mid-January, I guess the 16th. What was the mood in Tabriz?
The mood in Tabriz
at that stage.
I can describe that exactly. I had a squad of about 15 or 20 Iranian soldiers, most of whom by chance, well, none of whom were from Tabriz itself. All of these guys were Kurds from Kurdistan, or they were from the Caspian Sea area. When they heard that the Shah had left, they almost became emotionally berserk. In fact, they were very, very upset, extremely upset, The city of Tabriz had burst out into sort of wild jubilation, with people, honking horns and throwing candy and cookies and things like that, and roaming around in cars, and with the tops down or the windows down or whatever, and sort of singing and chanting, and Yeh Khomeini, etc. Because the consulate was on the main street, or on one of the main streets, and because it was the American consulate, every one of these cars and trucks and buses, of course, passed by the front gate. Well, very, very quickly, when the soldiers were still extremely upset, one of these cars passed by, stopped, and was honking and yelling out whatever, death to the Shah, I'm sure, and death to Carter, I'm sure, and long live Khomeini. A whole group of the soldiers, 7, 8, 10 of them, rushed down and were about to attack the car. They pulled their guns and I stopped them. And gave a long lecture in Persian. Basically, put your guns away, you fools. But it worked. And I got them to go back into the little barracks they had there. I was afraid if they had done any shooting, that would have been the end of the consulate right there.
I dare say.
Yeah, it was interesting. Because all my years of teaching Iranian, my years as a teacher in Iran, where I could start to scream at Iranian students, telling them what to do, that was the most serious time that ever happened.
Now, you're still performing consulate duties at this stage?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This is as usual during the day, to some extent.
To a large extent, because, now I had a lot of Iranians who, a lot of the officials and members of the upper class coming in via the Iranian equivalent of the back door, calling me up and saying they wanted to see me in private and coming over with their passports, their family's passports. Certainly many of the top people from the local administration wanting to get visas as an insurance in case they had to get out of the country. And in fact, some of them got out on those visas.
Now, when Khomeini returned on February 1st, he announced the demonstrations would continue until Bakhtiar fell from power.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of response did the Ayatollah get in Tabriz?
By February, mm-hmm. Tabriz, I would say, was more in the hands of the revolutionaries than in the hands of any local administration. Certainly, I'm trying to remember, the days now, but I think it was about the end of the first week in, or by February 8th, 9th, I don't remember the day that the armory fell in Tabriz, but there were constant demonstrations, lots of general noise in the street, lots of gunfighting, and Tabriz for about a week was an open battleground. Certainly, I'm saying about a week, it was about a week, and that ended on the 14th. I left Tabriz on, I think, the 15th or 16th of February, but certainly up until the 14th, when I was still free, it was true that lots of fighting on the streets, lots of people got killed, a fair number of houses, including two houses in the immediate vicinity of the consulate, were put under siege because there were police officials or SAVAK officials in the houses. Mm-hmm. One of them joined the back wall of the consulate. The back wall of the house joined the back wall of the consulate, and that house was literally laid siege to by a mob. The occupant of the house was a SAVAK commander from a different city who had come to stay with his parents. And the crowd had discovered this.
Mm-hmm.
But this went on for quite a while. And once, of course, the armory out at the army base was broken into, a couple of thousand weapons got distributed. And the shooting just continued then for many days in the second week of February.
So there was a shooting between the revolutionaries and what was left of SAVAK and the military that was still loyal?
SAVAK military that had turned and turned back again, and police officials.
Well, some had turned towards revolution and then turned back?
Well,
turned against
in the sense that the military had laid down their weapons, uh-huh. had, you know, done what they call the surrender and the submission to Khomeini, mm-hmm. and then were laid, you know, then were attacked by crowds who overran some of the bases. And had to respond, had to try and defend themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, I traced this period in a couple of different cities. An awful lot of people died in that second week of February. People whose names have, you know, been totally forgotten, and their families are gone and dispersed, so nobody really knows about it anymore. But an awful lot of policemen, especially. It was hard if you were a policeman that had been seen in uniform every day for years and years. It was hard to suddenly pretend you were a revolutionary. And I know of two different towns, small towns, where the local police forces were basically butchered. You know, everyone in the police force was butchered. Tabriz certainly lost a lot of policemen at that point. It's a bit strange. I'm still not sure whether that was truly a popular reaction against the police or whether it was something that was led by the Mujahideen or the Fedayeen as part of a plan to get rid of the old security forces. You know, one of those first steps in causing chaos that you can benefit from.
A combination.
Or a combination, or just the general exuberance that comes out in the crowd when you get too much adrenaline.
Now, during this period, in early February, Ambassador Sullivan and D.C. and Nas were trying to facilitate an orderly transfer of power from Bakhtiar to Khomeini of Tehran. How much did you know about these negotiations? Were you out of the loop, as they say?
I couldn't even be reached by telephone.
Yeah.
I was communicating with the embassy basically by radio.
That's something.
Yeah. Because the communications were down and open and dead and up and down and, you know, basically, I was using a radio, and that was it. No other way was possible.
Of course, in Tehran, of course, between the 9th and 11th of February, the Bakhtiar regime collapsed after the Air Force cadets and technicians began a mutiny outside of Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
And you prepared a memo to describe your experiences in Tabriz during this period. This memo was later included in the captured documents. Published in Tehran later on. Is there anything you want to add to that?
No, the memo is a good jog of my memory, but you know, I certainly couldn't. I know what's happened to some of the people, you know, as time went on. Mm-hmm. Does the memo cover? I haven't reread it totally, but does it cover what happened to the people who actually attacked the consulate later on?
I'm not sure about that.
No.
In later months. No, just on that week.
I don't know if you're going to read this into the tapes, are you?
We can add that as an appendix to your transcript. I think that might be useful.
The one thing that I can add is that the people who actually attacked the house, some of them were later killed. I know that in the fighting. And one of them, I did this memo in March. I went back to Tabriz about a week or 2 weeks after I did this memo. It would have been about 6 weeks after the attack. And I went back because I was being given back, or the consulate was being turned over to the American government again. It had been in the revolutionary hands since February when I left it. Well, all that was fine. I went back and it was occupied totally by a group of Air Force homophiles, you know, the sort of Air Force technicians,
mm-hmm.
who were extremely friendly, hospitable, etc., etc., etc. In fact, the couple of nights that I was there, I stayed with them in the consulate instead of sleeping in my old bedroom, which by this point looked like a stable. I slept with them on the floor of my old living room. You know, they had turned it into a barracks. Well, that was the first night. The second day, I had gone out somewhere into the city, I had come back, and the head of the Homophar group saw me coming into the compound, came over and said, I have a surprise for you. I want you to meet somebody. Fine. And he pulled this other guy over, you know, normal Iranian with a beard, and said to me, do you know him? Do you recognize him? And the guy looked familiar. I said, he looks familiar, but you know, not really. I can't place him. Could be anybody. And the homophobe said, this is the guy who was head of the group that, you know, attacked your consulate a month and a half ago and took you to prison. I want you two to make up. But what can I say? The items that were stolen at that time from the vault included the Tabriz consular seal, my passport, my diplomatic ID card, a variety of other items. They disappeared. I mean, they were in a sealed bag. They disappeared in this with this group. I'm trying to think of when this happened. About 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I got a call from the State Department saying that this bag of items had shown up again. An Iranian woman in Tehran had gotten in touch with the Swiss intersection of the Swiss embassy, told them that she had been going through a trunk that her son kept locked in his bedroom because her son was no longer in the country, and had discovered this bag of items. And she anonymously returned them all to the Swiss, and they returned them all to us.
So the consul seals back up.
Yes, it's back, and the visa stamps and all that. So. Although you couldn't get very far today on a visa issued in Tabriz.
And when did you arrive in Tehran after the incident at the consulate? I guess mid-February.
I'm just trying to think. The embassy was seized and held on February 14th.
Yeah.
I knew that people were out. They were out by the 15th or so. I was picked up on that day or the next day. It must have been around the 17th, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Tehran before you went back to work?
I went back to work immediately,
by the way.
Nobody could work inside the embassy chancery because it had been so badly tear gassed trying to get the demonstrators out that it became impossible to occupy. If you're ever in a situation like that, remember that carpets, drapes, and upholstery suck up tear gas and hold it. So if you want to go back into a room that's been gassed, you have to remove all the carpeting, wall-to-wall carpet, all the drapes, all of the upholstered furniture. It took a long time. And people had to do it wearing gas masks. But anyway, we worked out of the DCM's house or the ambassador's residence or wherever.
What were your new duties in Tehran?
Political officer. Political officer and general factotum. We had very few people left. Most of the embassy staff was evacuated. I think we went down to about 25, 30 people. Out of several hundred.
This is during the spring, I guess.
This is in February.
In February, okay.
Yeah. This is when Ambassador Sullivan was still there. DCM, Charlie Noss was there. And it was before Sullivan was gotten out of the country. But basically a little bit of everything. Partially my responsibilities included maintaining a general eye and liaison with the variety of groups that had occupied the embassy. And also establishing liaison with all the new revolutionary groups. It was interesting times. And doing reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the reporting you've seen starting again immediately in February.
Mm-hmm.
What people were saying about the revolution, what was happening to the former officials, former leaders, former friends of the United States. I met with a whole series of people who were en route out by escaping, who just wanted to touch base at the embassy before they took off across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And with people who thought they were going to be part of the new government. And it just went on like that. Business was booming. I mean, it was literally, we were extremely busy. There were hundreds of people who were trying to see us, or thousands if you prefer, for a whole variety of reasons. Everything from, please give me a visa, to I'm an American citizen and I need help, to, you know, I'm a new member of the revolutionary government.
Mm-hmm. Now, one prominent prisoner escaped was General Tufanian, who, I guess, was in prison, then he got out of prison somehow.
I don't know.
Is there any embassy role in helping him out? Or?
I've never heard of any. Yeah, I know Tupanian's here in the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
But Tupanian was so rich, he had stolen so much there that he would have had no trouble driving his way out.
Now, did you engage, did you return to the U.S. at any time during this period, 79? Did you come back to the United States for
roughly in July.
Yeah,
I think it was July.
Uh-huh.
I shouldn't have said that about Tupanian having stolen money. It just always surprised me that a general on such a low salary could be such a well-known multimillionaire. But I guess he... Many Iranian generals have the morals of Marcos. These are normally the ones who blame Carter for the revolution.
Indeed, they do.
And the more they stole themselves, the more they blame Carter. For not having given them more of an opportunity, I guess.
Speaking of Carter, now, how would you describe the Carter administration's general stance towards the new regime, you know, say during this period, during the late winter, spring of 79? What was your impression?
Late winter of 78?
79. You know, late winter 79.
Okay, so 79.
Yeah, yeah.
The revolution's happened, Khomeini's in power.
Yeah, yeah.
Not immediately, certainly not immediately unfavorable. We had people like Andy Young calling Khomeini a saint.
Mm-hmm.
He was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. We had various American officials who had tried to see Khomeini in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
We were certainly working with the Iranian government immediately, the new government. You have to remember that a lot of the new officials were old friends of the United States, or had studied in the United States, or had just come from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, this would be the Bazargan cabinets, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, at that period, my recollection is not anti-Khomeini. The jury was still out on him. They were doing some awful things, but it was a revolution, and people understood that. It only started getting bad as time went on. But there was a long period. We worked, you know, I mean, when I say worked with them closely, I mean, when we certainly had a fairly friendly relationship, and certainly a cooperation, getting embassy work done, you know, getting things through customs, getting shipments in, getting personnel in, getting personnel out,
mm-hmm.
all that sort of normal administrative work was going on quite well,
mm-hmm.
considering what was happening to the rest of the country. And we dealt... It was a bit more chaotic, and you had a lot more officials who didn't know what they were doing on the Iranian side. But basically, we had no problems that were not surmountable.
Mm-hmm. Now, since there had such a high level and strong commitment to the Shah over the years, were there any officials in the State Department and the embassy who were rather, you know, were sort of embittered by the revolution, given their lengthy support, long-standing support for the Shah, the old system?
The problem was those people, yeah. those American officers or officials, who had dealt with Iran for a long time,
mm-hmm.
were losing numbers of friends to the executioner squads. It was very, very difficult, or if not impossible, to be neutral about that. When you saw a photograph of a friend on the front page of the paper, you know, and your friend was lying on a marble slab, having just been executed, it's really difficult to be bland.
Wait till it's over.